What's up, WTD listeners? On episode 4, we bring you former Oregon defensive backs coach John Neal. Coach Neal was with the Ducks from 2003 through 2016 before retiring from on-field coaching. He spent 2017 and 18 at UAB as an analyst before returning to Eugene and spending the 2019 season as an analyst for the Ducks. He is the only coach in school history to win 3 Rose Bowls.
My first question was going to be talking about actually the D-Boys and how that started and that class of guys that went on to play in the NFL.
Yeah, that's an easy answer because I can remember when it started, and that was Matt Harper. Mm-hmm. Matt Harper was the leader of that group. Matt's now has been coaching with the Philadelphia Eagles for quite a while now in different capacities. And I think he's with the wide receivers now, but he was with special teams and, you know, one of the great people I've ever coached. And he just coined it, and then it just took off. And, it became a little bit of a cultural thing, meaning that I think you had to kind of prove yourself to be called that within the group. And it wasn't me. The players did it, which is the greatest strength in the world. When things are going great in a culture, the players are the ones that are creating the culture and believing in it and then expanding on it, making it better. And so we were able to keep that going for a long time throughout the different players that, you know, I coached. And it became a little bit of a, you want to be a part of this. And I was really, really fortunate that I had the right guys that created the right culture. And I was Jarris Bird and TJ Ward. And they just kept going. So many players, John Boyette, Eddie Pleasant, Thomas Jackson. And Patrick Chung. And I don't know if I hadn't said him already. And then a couple of the unsung heroes, Eric Dargan and Avery Patterson, were two of the best safeties in the country their senior year. And they both made, I think, maybe second team all league. And they both should have been first team. We had almost an undefeated season, and they were just absolutely phenomenal football players. They both had about, between them, I bet you they had 14, 15 interceptions and 5 or 6 touchdowns. But anyway, they kept it going. And then I think when we had a little bit of a change, defensive coordinators, and we had a couple defensive coordinator changes after Coach Aliotti left. And I think we kind of lost that kind of momentum, unfortunately. And, people got to believe in it to make it work.
Definitely. And I loved how you brought up just proving it to each other. And that kind of that first group of guys, Harper, Bird, Chung, TJ Ward, it was not necessarily what, you know, you'd look at as your most highly recruited group nationally. But like when you go back and watch like that Oklahoma State game in 2008 in the Holiday Bowl and just some of those hits, I mean, when those guys got to campus, can you remember a time before the fans knew about them when you were like, whoa, like these guys have scary potential?
Well, you know, the truth is that they all redshirted, so I was able to have that extra year to, you know, let them develop and, you know, learn things. I think it was more of a standard back then. And I think that's the difference. And nowadays, because of the social media, internet, ability to instantly get information on athletes that you can nationally recruit. So there's a stigma, well, he's a 5-star player. Well, you know, a couple of those guys were NFL all pros. They were all pros, not just starters. I mean, they all started. And so I think that's kind of you got to be careful on what you think you're getting. And like Oregon's doing now, Oregon's doing a fabulous job, and they are nationally recruiting, and they're being successful at it. And I think a lot of times when I look back at the end years of me recruiting at Oregon, the difference was we weren't being successful at national recruiting. And I wish we would have, you know, kind of stayed the Washington route. Like when I lost Elijah Molden, I happened to see something today where he's the number 2 ranked cornerback in the NFL draft next year. And, you know, his dad played here. His mom went to school here. I recruited him for 3 years, you know, from a sophomore year, and we didn't get him. And that was kind of an idea of, when we lost that momentum, you know, and couldn't get it back. And, I'm glad he's finally done, so I don't have to keep looking at him, how good he is.
Definitely.
He's good. And he's the best kid in the world, believe me. He's the one that, when he decided to go to Washington, he called me personally and told me why, and I couldn't say anything. They were going up and we were going down. It was kind of a tough pill to swallow, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I know you mentioned his dad was a legend at Oregon. And but going back to your talking about national recruiting, at that point early in your career coaching at Oregon, and I know at that point there was some regional, like guys, coaches would be assigned a region sometimes. And I know that's not as big of a thing anymore.
No, that's how we did it.
Yeah. And at that point, when you're just going to watch practice and you're looking at these guys who are not the internet sensation, so to speak, what kind of things at that point were you looking for, like in the eye test for guys that you wanted to be your guys to play for you?
Well, that's a good big point. You know, I'd like to think I had an easy answer, you know, for it. But most of all, just who's your best player? Who's the best player on your team, coach? You know, I'm talking a high school coach. You know, who can do the most? I want to see someone. Like, I remember watching John Boy at plate. He was a quarterback, and he was the best player. And the things he could do with the football in his arms, and I just converted that to movement, change of direction. Even he's that kind of kid that would jump over people when he was running the ball. Same with Jairus Burr. He was a quarterback in high school and led his team to a state championship. And, you know, he could do some things with the ball in his hands. And I just said, look, this is the best player on the team. You know, and I didn't even ever see him in person. I just watched film. We recruited him late because his dad was friends with John Ramsdale, who coached at Oregon for years and years and was the receiver coach with the Rams in St. Louis at the time. So John called Nicky Aliotti and said, hey, you know, why don't you take a look at this guy? And we went, oh, okay. Yeah, so it was kind of late in the process, but we lucked out and got him. You know, Pat Chung, I recruited when I at his, he was at Rancho Cucamonga High School, and there was about 11 players on that list. A couple of them were guys that you would call blue chip. They went to USC. Like in the old days, everyone that was a blue chip went to USC. Wasn't even a debate. They just went and you just left them alone. But come around, the 11th guy was Pat Chung, and in those days we used, you know, VCR tapes. You know, so when you put those in, they were really hard to see. They would be grainy and wavy, and coach would put one guy, but there was no like break in it. You know, they didn't know when it broke and who you watching out. There's no cool graphics to show circles like they do in huddle. I'll tell you about a good huddle story someday too, but. There was one play, just one, where I happened to notice this, there's a kickoff and this guy goes downfield and he just runs right over the ball carrier without hesitation. And I said, who's that guy? He said that, well, and he looked at me like I'm supposed to know, that's Patrick Chung. And so I kept that kind of deep in my heart. And I just said, I went and watched him prep play a game and he had an interception that, he goes, coach, what do you think of the interception? The guy threw it right at him and hit him right in the stomach. And I went, yeah, that's a great play. You know, right place at the right time. And I went on my gut instinct, and I was fortunate. I did it also on some other guys, and I didn't make the right choice on a couple guys. Not a couple, but a few. You know, I missed. I kind of thought the same pattern. So, you know, I was lucky and unlucky too. You know, I mean, Jairus Burr I took because he, I think it was the state championship game, last play of the game, he runs kind of an option play and he gets trapped and he just stops and he turns sideways and jumps completely over the pile for the winning touchdown. And I went, I'm taking this guy. Now, it's different than they do now. You know, you got a lot more reasons that you're looking for. You know, Walter Thurman, I saw him as going into his junior year and his coach said, this guy's at the time he was a better and well-known hurdler because he was under 15. In the 120 highs, and you know, anything under 15 is fast for a football player, especially going into his junior year. So we were standing out, kid, coach named Mike Maggiore. He went out. He played at Oregon State when I was at Oregon State. He used to kind of take care of me when I went to see him at his high school. And he introduced me to Walter, and that's right next to the softball fence, you know, for the women's softball. And, you know, I'm thinking that fence is about standard 4 feet, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, I just made a joke. I said, hey, bud, hop over that fence real quick. And he did. He just went, zoom, zoom, and he jumped over twice. And I went, did anyone else just see that? I mean, how did you do it? He didn't even hardly, look like he didn't even hardly bend his knees. He just had this incredible skill to jump. And I took him off. I have to be honest with you, I took him off that. And, you know, I watched film and stuff, but that film back then was so grainy and hard to see. But later that year, after he had committed to us, that coach made a really good film of him, and it got out. And all of a sudden, you know, everyone was coming after Walter. And so, again, he was such a class act that he didn't change his mind, never for a second. He didn't pull out what the kids are doing now. You know, thanks for getting my 50th offer. He stayed with his commitment, and it benefited all of us, you know. You know, great people, you know, do great things, and he was one of them, you know, that he was bigger than just being a player. Uh-huh. He proved it now. He's a motivational speaker all over the country right now. It's like, am I surprised? Of course not.
Definitely. And some of these guys you keep mentioning, Thurman, Ward, John Boyette, for that, you know, matter. I mean, these guys, I remember growing up watching them. I mean, your guys were hitters. And I know practice rules and whatnot have changed, and there's not as much full speed hitting as there used to be. But I mean, I know that talking to some of your guys who you've coached, they say Coach Neal would lose it over missed tackles.
Yeah.
I mean, how were you, like, instilling that kind of, like, instinct in these guys just to get the guy to the ground?
That is, you know, it's the toughest skill in all of football is tackling. It's not even close. It's not catching the ball or throwing the ball or blocking. It's tackling, you know, tackling someone when you don't know what direction they're going and all that good stuff. Well, years ago, I don't know if you remember, you're a young guy, but there was a Louisiana Tech team. Actually, Gary Croton was the head coach. Gary ended up coaching here with us for a while. And they had this phenomenal offense. They went up and beat Nebraska. I don't know if you remember this. This is a great story. Guy had 7 touchdowns, I think, in one game as receiver. He was phenomenal. And Tim Rattay was the quarterback, NFL guy. But when we played them, I had a safety. He's now a vascular surgeon out of UAB named Alan Willis. And we lost that game in the last seconds. But as I was grading his film, I said, man, this guy made 17 tackles today. He didn't miss a tackle. So he was 17 of 17 in attempts, which is phenomenal. It's like John Boyette made like 14 or 15 tackles in the Rose Bowl and didn't get the MVP. He had an all-time record. But so that's when I started this process of tackling percentage. And it just happened. It's not like I had some kind of weird formula. I just kept it. Look, if you're a 90% tackler and you make 9 out of 10 tackles, you're probably going to be all conference. If you make 80%, you better hang on to your job, because now you're missing, you know, a couple more tackles. And if you're 70% or less, I'm moving you. You can't play. He can't play. So that's what happened. It's kind of a cool story. Matt Harper and I were just talking about it. Matt was starting, but Matt was missing 50% of his tackles. And so about the third game, and this is his story because I had to be reminded of it, something like that. He reminded me, he said, yeah, well, Coach, you called me in my office and said, if you have one more game where you're tackling under the 50%, I'm going to start someone else. And the next game, he made like 11 out of 11 tackles and went on and had nearly an all-conference season, was our leader. Everything worked out great for all of us. We needed him. He was the older guy and just had a level head about him. And so, you know, this kind of this will to tackle Nima came out, and it became everything. I mean, everything we do finish everything. You know, they always talk about finish, finish. And you can't do anything but practice tackling. You got to finish, even if it's two-hand touch on the hip, you know. So we tried to, I tried to instill that to all the players I've ever coached. And I would tell them, frankly, you can't tackle, you can't play. If you can't defend the deep ball, you can't play. If you misjudge a deep ball, you're one of those guys, you can't play. And that's that. You know, you have to be honest with them. And, you know, so the cool thing is that we went off that percentage, and it was really effective way to, you know, kind of see how productive we were, and then have a kind of some sort of realistic approach to it by numbers. And I'm not big on that kind of stuff, you know, rhythmics and stuff. I'm reading a book on how they manufactured the chip right now. I'm talking the microchip. And I'm leaving it, and they explain that. I go, I don't get it still. I just rather poke needles in my eyes, you know. So anyway, you know, those are the things that, again, great players respond to, and it's easy to coach great players that want to be great. You know, these guys want to be great. Michael Jordan wanted to be great. You know, Roy McIlroy, the golfer, you know, he was like 3 years old, and he was hitting the ball straight as an arrow, and he wants to be great. And, you know, you try to surround yourself with the best you can, people that want to.
Definitely. And even though some of these guys who are amazing players for you didn't get a chance to experience kind of the peak of Oregon's success, as you got into the Chip Kelly era, or even when he came as offensive coordinator, I want to hear what it was like from your perspective as a defensive coach in practice with the no-huddle offense. I mean, I have to think that was a way, way different than anything you'd ever experienced.
Oh, yeah. So we're on the ground front of it. And it was kind of interesting. It's kind of a two-part story. When Chip came in, he had obviously already been doing it. He was used to it. And as defensive coaches, we weren't. And I didn't know exactly what to expect. So when it started going on, I found myself constantly, like, let's say we're just doing 7-on-7 skelly drills, right? Pass, you know, offense versus defense, pass only, right? 7-on-7 is. And I found myself talking to a player that made an error, and the offense is already back up running a play, and I'm in the way. And I did it again and again and again. And I, you know, you're talking about a lot of years of having to kind of reformat your instant feedback on teaching, right? You want instant feedback. And we didn't do it. And then the reps we got in practice, and then it just snowballed. I mean, it snowballed that first spring we're out there. And I learned, this is how I at least felt about it defensively, because the strategy of tempo is a fundamental. It's a fundamental. It's a process that makes something work, and you have to defend that process right away. You got to know how in the world do you defend those things. So that's why guys, you know, when we started coming in early and they'd fake an injury right in the game, that was part of the strategy. You know, fake an injury. And, you know, slow the game down, you know, and Chip wouldn't let him do that. He wouldn't let us do it at all, and we didn't do it in practice. So after that first spring, there was a lot of talk, and Coach Pilati said, you know, I think we need to slow it down. And he was trying to figure it out too, you know, how fast can you go? And that's when I had an opportunity to tell the staff and what I felt. And I said, I think this is a strategy. And it's going to work because it's bothering us so much on defense. And then Mike agreed, and we never heard a word about it. And he let it go. And Mike, you know, Mike let Chip do his thing. Mike deserves a lot of credit for innovation and actually someone else doing it. You know, when you're the leader of the team and you're letting someone else sort of run that part of your team, it had a lot to do with Mike's confidence, and then it worked, and it was fantastic. And you know, eventually everyone in the country started doing it, and you learned how to defend it. But we practiced that way, Nima. We practiced that way all the time. And it just took off. And so when we did team stuff, like Alabama, I read, and I don't know this exactly, but I was told this. Well, I was told it by guys that work there, so I guess they know. But they would run something like 58 defensive plays in a practice, you know. And Coach Saban's deal is, you know, perfection and attention to detail, which we all want. But he had the kind of offense that, being a defensive coach, you know, he has the type of offense that caters to the defense. Ball control, Boise, University of Washington, Stanford. Those guys are ball control things, teams that help their defense. That's why statistically you'll see those teams normally in the top part of the stats, right? But for us, we might run 100 to 150 plays in practice. It's unbelievable. So we can never, you know, we could never stop. I mean, I can never see all the plays. So after practice, and I'd look at the screen, and this is including team, 7-on-7, different parts of practice, and I'd look at it, Nima, and go, God almighty, I'm going to be here till 3 in the morning. I'll never get through this. And so what we did is we'd come in as a defensive staff, and then we would kind of go through it and as much as we could try to detail it, right? And then we would I would be number one, and I would just yell out number one, and that meant I wanted to keep that play. And by the end of it, of those 100 plays, let's say I might have 30 plays that I'm going to go back in detail for my meetings for practice. So there's 70 plays that just disappeared into the, you know, where like an Alabama can detail 58 plays and you know, really get the details they want to execute the way they, you know, they have over the years. So, you know, officially with great players, but yeah, they're pretty good and good coaches too.
No, definitely. And I think the cool part with Oregon is there was so much continuity on staff, and Chip was really one of the only newcomers, so to speak. And when you look at how strong the culture on your staff was, I know I've heard before that he really stayed out of the defensive side of the ball. I mean, he trusted you guys to, you know, with what you were doing. As someone who, you know, you're going through a change as far as, you know, practice was much different, how much did it help the culture on staff that Chip trusted you guys, you know, with everything he did on the offensive side of the ball, he gave you guys, you know, full autonomy on the defensive side?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, because I've been on staffs where, you know, the head guy thinks he knows it all. You know, you may be the offensive coordinator, quarterback coach, and then you become the head coach, and all of a sudden you're an expert at every position, which is a fallacy. That's why you want to get really good people around you all the time. But don't forget, you know, Mike Bellotti was a big part of this too. I always get Mike. People miss Mike. Mike's the one that hired Chip. Mike's the one that let Chip do what he did, and then that really gave Chip the confidence. But we were all friends, but we start winning, Nima. And when winning is the result, then yeah, you better believe you become a believer. You know, because ultimately what else is there? That's what we're trying to do is win. And in order to win, everything has to work. You know, even the most elite teams, you know, when now it's, well, there's four or five only, what I call only truly elite teams right now, you know, Georgia, Alabama, LSU, and Clemson, Ohio State, five, let's say. I'm talking elite. Even Oklahoma, they're right on the border, but they keep getting beat, and quite convincingly, by those five other schools to some degree, you know, but they're still elite. But, you know, the rest of us, you know, we depended on other things. And like I said, it goes back to, you know, our system. And then we all believed in that system. And then the players believed in it. And then it just got bigger and bigger. And don't get me wrong, we became an elite team for X amount of years. We had an elite quarterback. We had elite defensive linemen. We had elite DBs, had a, you know, a couple elite offensive linemen, elite running backs, you know, Jay Stewart and Royce Freeman and
LaMichael.
I mean, those guys were elite, you know, and you know, so I sometimes stop myself and go, yeah, we were an elite team. We were number two in the country twice, you know, so I got to remember that. You know, that's the standard that Oregon's trying to climb to right now, again, is to be one of those elite teams that transfers over, and they are. That last year's team was an elite team. That was one of the better teams in Oregon football history.
Definitely. And you talk about, you know, being a believer in what was happening, and I know, as you know, Chip left and Coach Helfrich took over, getting to go to the playing the first college football playoff and winning the Rose Bowl that year and going to the championship game. When you look back on that season, it was probably the last time that there was really that magic that you guys were never out of a game and were always going to find a way. What do you remember about, like, what happened after you guys lost to Arizona that season and just how the rest of that played out?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the book, Nima. That's the book, and that's the change. And basically, this is what happened. We were all there together. We all had the success together. And then Chip left. And Chip took Jerry with him. So then we had a new head coach. And the new head coach was not there when Chip coined as an assistant win the day. So the new head coach was not there. The new offensive coordinator was not there. The new defensive line coach was not there. So we were able to, that team, you know, you and I could have coached to a Rose Bowl victory, right? Just you two, us two. That team was self-made. We had Marcus. You know, we had if you have an elite quarterback like Oregon did a year ago, an elite quarterback, you're going to win. It comes back to the quarterback so often anyway. But that change, we stopped saying win the day. You know, Mark came up with something different. He wanted his own identity, but it was different, and it didn't mean the same to me or any of the guys that had been there and the players. And then the new guys came in, the other coaches, they weren't there. They didn't believe in it, and that's not their fault. But now new players come in. They don't know what it is. Then in second year comes in, and, you know, more players are on the team. They weren't there. They didn't go through the culture change. After we lost to BYU in the Las Vegas Bowl, I think we lost 38-8. We got destroyed. And I knew it from the lowliest assistant to the head coach. We knew we had an identity problem on our football team. And something had to change. And again, I give Mike Belotti, Mike deserves all the credit in the world for this. Because after that game, I thought, he's got to fire some of us. I thought I might get fired. That's just as guilty as anyone else. We were all lousy. We lost our team. I could tell. I could feel it. No one cared. But he didn't say anything. He just said, look, we're going to meet, let's say Monday, whatever it was. But when he got to that meeting, he said to us, you know, I was going to bring you guys right in after the game, right after we landed in Eugene, bring you to the office and start ramping, yelling and threatening and things like that. And he said, but that wasn't the right thing to do. And again, this is what Mike never gets credit for. Mike was a really good politician and organizer, manager for us. Very thorough. He thought deeply about those things sometimes, as he would say, ad nauseum. He used that word all the time. But that was the beginning of the change of a culture right there. And that's what led to the night at Camp Harlow when Chip Kelly now was our brand new offensive coordinator. I think it was his first day. And we get this team and we drive our team. We don't say anything to anybody. We drive our team out to Camp Harlow, kind of a cafeteria setting, break them up in position. And Mike gets up and says, what's wrong with this team? And we had these big, I got this all, I say I because I did do it. I got this all from Franco Mendenhall, who I coached at Oregon State, and was now the head coach at BYU where I went to school. So Franco and I stayed in touch. And I went to one of his talks at the National Coaches Association and saw what he did to come into a new program and change the culture. He's the best culture changer in college football. There's nobody better than Bronco Mendenhall. He's amazing. He knew that he took Virginia to the championship game. I mean, they went to the bowl, won a bowl game. He is really that good, and they're lucky to have him. But anyway, I just took all that stuff from him, and over the course of a couple of months, we refined it to that night. And, man, we got up there, and players wrote it down, and for about an hour, it was really easy to write down what's wrong with this team. Easy. This, that, no details right now, but this and that, this guy, that guy, offense, defense, whatever. And so then we put them up on the walls, and then Mike gets back up and says, all right, what are we going to do to change it? So like, 10 minutes later, no one had anything up there. I mean, not very much. And we just started, that was the process right there. And then the next morning, that was a Thursday night, Friday morning, we had our normal 6 a.m. run with Jimmy Radd, and we did it different. We start out with up-downs forever, up-downs, until basically players started to quit. And it was really a funny Nima, really an interesting part of this is that there was 4 players on our team, again, not mentioning names, that did not show up that Friday morning and never came back to the team. And they were 4 of the most decisive players on our team. But they knew from that Thursday night that this stuff was serious. Mm-hmm. And at least I give them credit that they were smart enough not to fake it. They just left the program. I never saw any of them again, ever.
Just cleaned out and left.
Never. And then after the up-downs, we did a thing, and I stole this from Florida State, and this is what we did. This is on defense. Offense had their own thing. But Nick and the defensive coaches, this is what we did. So I stole it from Florida basketball when the guy who's Oklahoma City coach, was the head coach, won a couple national championships in Florida. And it was this deal where they run, liners all right. Touch the line, come back, touch the line, half court, come back, touch 3 quarters, come back, touch the far end and come back. And if you've ever played basketball, for some reason, we seem to have to do those every day. And they were really painful, man. It was tough.
It's the worst.
Well, yeah. And so we did those, but I did it on the football field. So I said, okay, from the sideline to the hash to the sidelines, 1. And so let's say that took 5 seconds. Well, you get 10 seconds rest. And then you go from the sideline to the hash, back to the sideline, to the middle of the field, and back to the sideline. That's 2. And let's say that took 10 seconds. Well, you get 20 seconds rest. Then you go 3 quarters and then a full deal. And each time, the only rest you get is twice as long as what it took you. And it's really hard, man, because now you're on the clock. Your recovery, my recovery, his recovery is all going to be different. So you really get exposed. It's like CrossFit. You get exposed when you start putting time and numbers and weight out there, right? And here's what happened. I lost track. It was my idea, and I lost track. I didn't know what line anyone was on, who time. They just kept doing it. So afterwards, this is the proof of the moment. A bunch of the players came up to me and said, hey, coach, we didn't finish. Can we finish? And the whole point was that I said to them, no, because the game's over. The game is over. We don't get to replay the game. That's it. But because of, that's to me, was one of the strongest things that ever came out of it, was they felt accountable, and then they were upset that they didn't make it. So then throughout that season, this is all the DBs. I said to the DBs, I said, look, guys, and again, Mike Bilotti let me do this because he had players on the sideline doing sit-ups and push-ups in between their reps. And a lot of coaches would say, well, I need you to watch every play on the sideline. But we were creating something different. I wanted them to believe that we were doing something that no one else in college football was doing, And so then that would be the edge when it came down to the really difficult parts of winning and losing, which is right torn up in the last few minutes or situations of a game. Definitely. And so, again, those guys did those things, man. They were on the sidelines doing push-ups and sit-ups and just maximizing their own culture and, you know, come up with the D-Boys with a Z, you know. I told them that's not exactly how you spell it, but it looked cool. and they loved it and they believed it. And, it helped me keep a job for a long time. And, you know, really to give those guys credit, you know, I'm sitting retired right now, and maybe if that didn't happen, I would have had to work for 3 or 4 more years or whatever. I mean, I got to give them some credit, thank them for helping me in my own life. You know, I know I helped them, but they got to know they helped me too. You know, and I think about TJ and Jairus and Patrick and Walter, all multimillionaires. You know, think about that. They're multimillionaires. And they're going to have pensions, NFL pensions, that are as some of the best stuff that you could possibly have to hand down to your children and, you know, give them benefits that will last their lifetime and, you know, probably their kids and their grandkids' lifetime. And maybe more than that, maybe farther than that. And, you know, and they all got their degrees, you know, which is, I always harped on. Deep down, I wanted them to make football, pro football, but I'd always downplay the pro football play, you know, being a pro football player, and just go, look, get your degree, because you're going to be more proud of that than anything. And cool thing is, I think almost all those guys, you know, got that, you know. And you know, on top of all this, Nima, you know, 2 weeks ago, I called Cliff Harris.
Yep.
You know, and you forget about Cliff. You know, was he part of that culture? Was he this or was he that? He got in trouble? Heck yeah, he was. He was an integral part of that culture. You know, nobody liked to play football more than the two guys. Well, there's a bunch of them, but that I remember just that loved football was DeAnthony Thomas and I'm losing my mind. Cliff, thank you. And I got stumbling there because I thought when I said love football, and I started going, oh, Patrick Chung, Jarrett, they all love football. And I thought I kind of stumbled around there. But Cliff and DeAnthony just always loved playing. And you don't think that created part of the D-Boys culture, and he was part of that D-Boys, and I forget about him sometimes. And he was a consensus All-American. You know, he was a phenomenal player. I happened to see not too long ago a video of him, a highlight video on YouTube, and it just reminded me. I went, man, this guy was phenomenal. And right now he's back home, and he's really getting his life together and really trying hard to he's going to get off probation here.
Next month, I saw on Facebook.
Trying all he can, and Cliff was the kind of kid I remember that. One time there was this kid, he was a walk-on from Oregon. Nobody talked too much. You know, just a guy, I liked him, you know, he's a try-hard guy, not very good player, but, you know, he's from Oregon, and we gave him a walk-on shot, and Cliff Harris is sitting next to him, helping him learn football, you know, where all these other guys thought Cliff was this and that. That was Cliff Harris. Cliff Harris was a really good person, a great football player that was caught up in all of the bad things that can happen to you if your life is dragged through the mud like his was. But for him to be deep down the kind of person he was, that's his true character, you know. And I always feel bad that I forget about him when I think of all the great players that I was, you know, privileged to coach, and he was definitely one of them.
Oh, no doubt. And I think that it's funny because in 2010 and 11, when he was really at his peak as a player at Oregon, was, you know, when media and stuff was not really, you know, privy to a lot, but this was just this fun-loving guy who was out there in the media talking and It seemed like Chip didn't mind either. You know, is that true? Was Cliff like that all the time?
Oh, I don't know. Cliff is Cliff, man. He said what's on his mind. I said, Cliff, sometimes, you know, just back off a little bit. But he was fun loving, yeah, man. He's a Natty guy. You know, he created Natty, you know. And they still say that. And that was Cliff coined that during the, you know, when we're getting ready to play Auburn. But yeah, Cliff always had probably something good to say, but, you know, he was just a fun guy. And he's funny, you know, he's a funny guy.
No, definitely. And before I let you go here, I do have to ask you, because I've had former players mention it. They always talked about how you were a guy who found a way to have balance in what's kind of become a crazy profession and with a lot of nut jobs. And so I'm curious how you were able to maintain that. And I know I guess your workouts are stuff of legend, according to some of them. So,
well, yeah, that helps. I was one of those people that, somebody that does CrossFit, they'll tell you, right? So I've been in the CrossFit world since it was before it was called CrossFit. And so I did all that really hard stuff. I would challenge my players because I knew I could get them in some of that world that they weren't used to. And they would think I was just, you know, stud. But just if they did it, they would kill me in a while. But now, you know what? Really, this is the bottom line about me is my faith. I'm a strong Christian believer. You know, I start there. I put my players there. I always thought about when I became a coach, how would I want it to be treated? You know, you care about them personally, and you try to find out more about them, and you know, you love these guys. I mean, these guys are, when you call them sons, you know, you do love them like a son. You know, that's a big deal, you know. And I think they knew that, and I think that's maybe why they trusted me the way they did, and trusted me, especially when I said, that's not good enough. That's just not good enough. You're not going to be the guy you want to be unless you do these things. And, you know, no-nonsense approach with a lot of love and communication, you know. I mean, I'm not the guy that said, just do what I say, not what I do. I tried to say, look, do what I do. I mean, I ran around on the field like Jimmy did. Jimmy was Jimmy. No one can do what Jimmy does. But I ran to the ball with those kids, and I had Kwame Ajumon, who I coached and was a GA and consultant at Oregon now, run with me, because I thought the only way I think I can get these guys to play hard is if I constantly am pushing them to play hard, and then the results are what they are, you know, and that means that you can walk out of there with your head up going, look, I did the best I could. I think that's kind of what the bottom line for us all was. And, you know, got a bunch of rings, and I'm fortunate I've got three rings from Oregon, that winning rings from the Rose Bowl, and no one else does but me. I had to say it. I said it. Okay. I'm the only coach that has three rings of wins in the Rose Bowl. Like, hey, that's a big deal, you know? So, again, thanks to players and the guys that hired me.
Oh, definitely. And, Coach, I really appreciate it. This was awesome. Yeah. I mean, okay. Really great. Thank you.
Okay, bud. All
right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening all the way to the end. Don't forget to follow our Instagram at WTDPod. Be sure to check back next week for more Duck content.